Hey dog, do you like BarkBox?
Well, you heard them, folks. And luckily for you, BarkBox is offering an opportunity to receive one free extra month of BarkBox at BarkBox.com.
For humans, BarkBox is a delivery of 4 to 6 natural treats and super fun toys curated around a surprise theme each month. For dogs, BarkBox is like the joy of a million belly scratches.
To receive 1 month free, go to getbarkbox.com/babes. Again, that's getbarkbox.com/BABES.
From Cabernet to Malbec, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Ginny.
I'm Jen.
I'm Nat.
And we are the art history babes.
Yo, we're What's here.
Up? Yeah, we're here.
Damn.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's damn, been a week. Damn is a good way or, to open.
Not even a week, like a matter of short days.
Yeah. We're recording right after an incredibly tumultuous and horrifying weekend in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And we're pissed off about it, to say the least.
Many people are.
I'm What's stressed.
I keep seeing that meme that's like, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. Which Word. Comes up again and again at various points in time. But right. like, it is right. especially prevalent.
I feel
right
like
now.
That was like a legit quote from someone and that turned into a like big meme.
Yeah.
But it's true.
It keeps recurring because it keeps being relevant, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Right. So as we know, even if you don't live in this country, I feel like most people in the world know what's going on. We're having this incredibly just appalling surge of blatant white supremacy in this country. And it all really came to a head in Charlottesville, Virginia, where this event between pro-white nationalists and anti-fascist, Black Lives Matter protesters, basically a huge clash between people who think that being white is the best and people who think that everyone has human rights clash, and it ended in the loss of life, and which was a just extremely appalling and just heinous incident. And it's really scary.
Super scary.
It's terrifying. Yeah. And it all, so it kind of started with the attempt to, like, remove a Confederate statue.
Right. Which a
Robert
lot
E. Lee,
of,
right?
Yeah, a lot of correct. Cities across America are beginning to do that. I mentioned one briefly on the Egyptomania episode where I talked about a obelisk in New Orleans that was removed that commemorated a battle during the Civil War. And they, when the workers took it down, they had to wear protective bulletproof and helmet gear because white nationalists were threatening to kill anyone who tried to take this monument down. So it's it stemmed from a similar thing going on in Charlottesville, and it just escalated and
into people that
really
thought they were somehow protecting history, but really they were protecting
which is
their,
such, yeah,
their
it's
white the, history.
Yeah, it's the biggest bullshit.
It is.
It is. But and I do want to like mention just for the not even devil's advocate, but to show this how slippery of a slope it is, because I had a younger family member, like young adult, who was basically like, well, but it's just a statue. And when was it created? If it was created back in the Civil War, like basically trying to make the argument that a lot of people make that like it's historical rather than holding any weight. And it's like, all you need to do is look at everything that's happened from the start of the conversation of taking it down to realize that it's not just a statue.
Yeah.
Like, everything that follows is enough evidence to explain how much meaning these statues carry, and honest, like, hateful meaning. Like, they symbolize, like, oppression, and, like, there's no other way to put it.
Yeah, and especially placement, because this was in front of a fucking courthouse. Like,
yeah.
that's... I mean, it's one thing if you want to, in terms of using history as a lesson and preserving certain things about our history that we shouldn't forget, and if nothing else, so that we don't repeat stupid shit like this. But there's a way to do that, and if you want to do that, it should be put into some kind of a museum or something. It should not be in front of a building that's meant to represent justice.
Yeah, because...
and I saw this, like, tweet that, like, perfectly summed it all up. There aren't statues of Hitler in Germany.
Yes.
But there are memorials to the people who died in the Holocaust.
Yeah.
That's how you fucking do it. Like, they didn't erase their history.
Yeah.
But they are not...
Glorifying
the horror. They are making the history clear, and it's like it's not that hard. It's not that difficult. It shouldn't be that difficult.
Also, if you're a diehard like American constitutionalist, seceding from the Union is treason.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're gonna be, you know, this person who claims to be patriotic and this is American history, blah, 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 fine, but read the Constitution.
Yeah.
Okay? So, I don't know. It's so stupid. And just the fact that there's, you know, everything really exploded overnight. And now all you have to do is log on to any social media and you're entrenched in this argument that makes no sense. It makes no sense that there's an argument. And I just want to make this point right now because it's been driving me crazy. There is no such thing as alt-left, all right?
Not real.
Alt-left is not real. There are Nazis and there are people who are against Nazis.
Exactly.
You can call them whatever you want, but don't call them alt-left.
And I'm against, honestly, I mean, like, I understand the phrase alt-right, but fuck the phrase alt-right. They're Nazis. Let's call them Nazis.
Exactly.
Let's get rid of this alt
They're
bullshit.
They're carrying Nazi flags, so it's not even like us sitting here trying to like label them. They literally carried the swastika.
They were doing the Heil symbol.
This whole like battle over like the semantics is just making me crazy, and I'm just so sick of it. And so, you know, fuck alt-left. I don't ever want to hear that word again. And also, alt-right. Call them what they are. They're Nazis. And on top of that, if you're one of those people who's calling for compromise among both sides, and both sides were at fault, and can't we just all love and hatred is not the answer. It's like, fuck you. Shut up, all right? You're not helping at all. If you're the person who is trying to come in between and be like, hey guys, we can work something out. There's nothing to work out. You're either a Nazi who thinks that racial cleansing is a good thing and that Jews, people of color, people with disabilities should be dead so that you can promote the white race, or you're someone who is pro-human rights and anti-hate. So you're either one or the other, and you have to choose. You cannot be in the middle.
And the thing about that standpoint is it comes from this gross misunderstanding of what love is. Because if you love something, you protect it, and you stand up for it, and you stand up for what's right, and sometimes it gets messy.
Yeah.
Love is not pacifism. Like, it's just, like, love, obviously, in a perfect utopian world, we can just all get along, but that's not the world we live in, and love stands up for what it cares about. And I agree, not intentionally inciting violence is a good thing to aim for, obviously. None of us want that, but if Nazis are murdering people, you fight back.
Yeah.
Like, you don't stand there and try and find the middle ground.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't do that.
You have to pick a side. There's no middle ground here. And if you're somebody who doesn't have an opinion, if you're someone calling for compromise, if you're somebody who is trying to see both sides of the issue.
Like our piece of shit president.
You think that you're not getting involved, you are contributing to the problem.
Absolutely.
Because by not choosing a side, you are enabling the oppressor. And that is real. And you have to make up your mind. Don't be this, like, neutral person when you obviously are seeing what's happening in the news. If you're saying that you're neutral, you're really saying that you're fine because you're not in any danger.
Yeah.
You know?
Being neutral in the face of hate is just as much of a problem. Like,
well, it's a privilege. Then
yeah.
It's,
yeah. You know, if you're a person of color, then you're automatically, you're not neutral because you're like, oh shit, like I could get lynched on the street if things keep going this way, or, you know, ran over by a car in a crowd of people. That's just real, and I don't know.
And I totally agree. And the thing is, I'm also a person who, philosophically speaking, like, I don't like black and white ever. I think pretty much everything operates in the gray area. Yeah. I believe in always looking at both sides. I believe in all these things. Not in this situation.
Yeah.
This is one of those few situations where, no, you take a stand on the right side of history. Like, this is, don't play in the fucking gray area. If you are, it represents your privilege, and it says not good things about you. So if you're waiting in that place right now, like, think about your humanity.
And I want to acknowledge, like, I don't know, like, all this shit about, like, the media and stuff that's been going on since the presidential election. And, like, I have to say, the way that the media handled this to me was just so frustrating, because at first when they were, like, being, like, a car, and they were making it so gray, and in my mind I was just like, oh no, don't tell me that a counter protester did this.
Oh,
and that's
yeah.
the way that I felt that they were setting it up.
Yeah.
The way that they, I think, set it up at first, being like, oh, we don't know a lot. It's like, they knew right away, but they wanted to kind of, this is my perspective, I'm complete speculation, but the way that it appeared to me is that they wanted to drag it out like it could have been a counter-protester. So someone,
a friend on Facebook who, for some reason, she must have misheard or something, and I don't know why she jumped on Facebook, but she heard from a news source, or I think probably misheard from a news source, that the woman who died, Heather Heyer is her name, rest in peace, that Heather Heyer was on the side of the Nazis. And it, like,
wrong.
It hurt me that not only, like, that she thought that, but then, like, she went to Facebook and said something about it. Because I was like, you're spreading the wrong information. This person was trying to defend people and do something good, and she, her life was taken from her. Like, this is someone we should,
she's a straight
respect.
Martyr.
Yeah.
For real.
And in no, you know, it's not in no way saying this person on my Facebook, it's their fault or something. Like I said, I think it was very much a misunderstanding. But, like, it's
well,
just,
did
like,
she delete the post?
I think probably, so. I don't think it still exists. But, like, and obviously, she's very anti-Nazi, too. So it's totally a misunderstanding situation. But, like, but yeah, this media frenzy about it, on top of the way our piece of shit president has dealt with it, it's given people wiggle room to decide what this situation actually
is. And the wording,
is.
Again, I mean, because a Fox News reporter called the dude that drove the car and murdered that woman a vigilante. And it's like,
no, he's a fucking
terrorist.
Batman was a vigilante.
Yeah, does that person not know what vigilante means?
Yeah.
This person was a terrorist who was a neo-Nazi. There's photos of him engaged in a pro-white nationalist protest that a group called Vanguard America, who is literally a white nationalist, white supremacist group. There's photos of him engaged in these sort of, you know, whatever protests, actions. I don't know what the hell you want to call them. But he was a neo-Nazi, is a neo-Nazi, And even this group is trying to be like, well, he's not with us. You know, it's like, even if he went and picked up your stupid fucking shield, that still doesn't matter. Like, the fact that these people are getting caught up in semiotics, or not semiotics, semantics. This is what was really frustrating to me today. I got into this, I got pulled in, you guys.
I got, easy to do. I've been spending a lot more time the past couple days on Facebook and Twitter than I normally do. And I got pulled in. This is the reason I went off of it for a while. It's just,
I'm just about to deactivate my Facebook because it happened to me today.
It gets rough.
Blood pressure shot up. I swear. Like, I got pulled into this argument with some doofus who claims that, oh, it was a fight or flight response. People were banging on his car and he panicked.
Yeah, that's the stupidest.
There's
shit.
No proof that he's a neo-Nazi. And then all these people are, like, showing all these images. Like, look at him here at this white nationalist gathering. Well, that's white nationalist. That's not Nazi. That's the same thing.
Mine posted a video of him driving his car into the crowd. There is no...
I didn't watch the video. I couldn't watch it.
I follow Time on Instagram. They posted it. It's, I mean, it's graphic, but it's not so graphic that you can't,
like, watch it.
But, like, he clearly drives his car, like, maybe 15, 20 yards down the road, full speed, gaining speed before he hits people. And obviously the first, like, however many people at the end of the crowd see him coming and jump out of the way, and that's really what you see.
Yeah.
But you see that, and then you,
and then
there's chaos, and then
he,
exactly,
yeah.
He 100% did it intentionally. There's no question in watching it.
I couldn't understand it. I was in this argument with this person who just was finding all these reasons for why he did what he did. No, there's no proof that he's a Nazi, even though his own mother was,
that
like, saying that he's a Nazi.
That and, woman, oh my God.
And then, like, at the end, of all of this was him being like, I'm not defending him.
Yeah, you are.
And I was like, I didn't know what to do. I felt like I was short-circuiting. Like, it hurts my head right now.
Yeah, like, it's the idea at the end of the day, like, you're right. Most of the time there are two sides to every story. And I am someone who also preaches understanding and patience. But this is, that is one of the times where it just...
We can't allow it. Shit.
No, you just can't. You just fucking can't.
And at the end of the day, the takeaway from this is that our current administration has absolutely emboldened these people who preach hatred and white supremacy.
Yep.
And we see that as evidenced by Donald Trump's response to this event. And that is the bottom line. This is happening because we have a president who said, hey, bigots, it's okay.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm not saying that white supremacists and neo-Nazis just popped out of nowhere.
No, not at all.
And exist all of a sudden. And I don't even think that they're going to go away. But they are bold, and they're out there now. And
They have a platform.
They have a platform.
They're not afraid anymore. And I'm sorry, but Nazis should be afraid.
Yeah.
Like, Nazis should be afraid.
What was it? Was it the senator to Virginia? Shoot.
I don't think so.
I forget. Governor. It was the governor of Virginia. He gave a speech way before Trump did, but he basically is firm in, like, go home. You are not wanted. You are not part of our Commonwealth. You are not contributed anything. You made us stronger by doing this, like, without you, like, against you,
mm-hmm.
like... And I appreciated that because I know nothing about the governor from Virginia, but he came out
because that's what you do
strong.
Yeah.
And
there were a lot of
room for interpretation. He was firm that this, it's black and white.
And there have been a lot of Republican officials that have said, like, Mitt Romney had a really great tweet, and I don't
fucking
think that
Cruz came out.
I know. I don't think that's.
I couldn't believe it.
I know. I mean, like,
that was my evidence that we're living in bizarro world. Is that Mitt Romney came out and said there's no middle ground
here.
Yeah,
he made a very firm statement against Nazis, and I was like, I didn't really think that this was something I would do, but I agree with Mitt Romney.
Yeah. You know? Like, we're just slowly watching, like, all of the people that you had, like, disdain for, like, rise above, like, this level of, like, what's yeah. acceptable. Like, all these people who used to be way below the line are, like, yeah. rising because there's just so much worse out there.
Now apparently. Use your power and get that piece of shit out of office.
Yeah. Yeah. Take him out. Pretty he bad, has to guys. Go. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, you already know where we stand on the presidency, and you are about to find out where we stand with this whole issue. The Art History Babes collectively have a message to these neo-Nazis, and the message is Nazi punks, fuck off.
Get the fuck out.
And that's yeah. really, and that's the bottom line. yeah.
That's what we gotta say. That's what we gotta say.
Now on to more violence.
Yeah.
We're on a roll.
We are on a roll. Okay, so obviously this is a really complicated, you know, political era we're in. And while this podcast is about art, politics and art are very related. So if this is something you want to talk more about, email us. Like, yeah. we'll talk more about it.
Art is easily. Politics.
Yeah. This is something we care a lot about. We're outspoken about it. And we plan on continuing that. So
yeah, we're not afraid to talk about it.
Yeah, not at all. So feel free to email us with your thoughts or your concerns, and we'll keep the conversation going. And we individually will be doing our best to kind of stand up against it in every way that we can. Also, something you can do on a positive level is you can donate to different pro-civil rights organizations yeah. in Virginia.
Southern Poverty Law is a great
one. Oh, yeah, that yep. is a good one. Yeah. So
Southern Poverty Law.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just if you feel hopeless right now, it's something little you can do.
Write a letter to your senator.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, write a nasty tweet to Donald Trump. We know that they get to him. Like, it really bothers him. That's yeah. why that's why he blocks people. Like, so there are things you can do, even if you can't physically, you know, stop a Nazi. There are things you can do. So do your best.
Yeah.
Try and stay strong. Stay positive. And today's episode, we're gonna talk, yeah, more about violence.
Yeah.
because we've actually planned this episode for a long time. This was not planned mm-hmm. off of the events this past weekend, but there are a lot of things that intersect yes. with what happened. So kind of interesting. We're doing an episode on boxing in art as a kind of precursor to the big Mayweather-McGregor spectacle, which is insane. Like,
I cannot believe how ridiculous this is.
It's ridiculous. Like, as okay, so personally, I have zero interest in boxing or MMA. It's not something I've ever really spent time watching. But about a month ago, like, my boyfriend brought up this fight that was happening, and I was like, I don't really care. And he's like, no, you have to watch this shit. And I was like, mm-hmm. okay. So he made me watch some of the videos of the press conference, quote unquote, because I don't even know why they call it that. But the press tour.
The mudslinging
yeah.
competition.
The press tour that Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor went on around the world, where they would sell out stadiums and they would just talk shit to each other. And it was the...
Ridiculous.
I was obsessed. I was like, what is this? This is absolutely insane. I have no idea what's happening. And it was just absolutely crazy. And also, I mean, Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather are fascinating figures, and the whole thing was a huge spectacle, and so it influenced this episode. And yeah, so we're going to talk about our art that has to do with boxing throughout history. We're going to talk about the spectacle of violence, and we're also going to talk about kind of just our personal feelings on this crazy ass spectacle that's happening right now.
I used to watch UFC a lot in high school, and so part of that has a weird kind of soft spot in my heart.
So funny, because you do not strike me as someone who's ever.
No, I
kind
of get that, because
I like
that shit. People, I mean,
but yeah,
no, I feel you.
I mean, and I do have respect for a lot of these. I mean, because they are athletes. Of course they're
yeah,
athletes.
Yeah, definitely.
It's
not easy to go out there and get
Get wrecked.
One fighter from Brazil, Anderson the Spider Silva, and he just had the longest legs, and he would go out and kick people, just, and it was beautiful. It really was. Just seeing that leg, just as when they would put it in slow motion, you'd see his muscles just like lock and ripple, and it was like he just knocked that dude the fuck out. So there is a weird fascination
I get it. Like, so I've never watched MMA. I've never watched mixed martial arts, but that does kind of interest me because when I was younger, I was really into martial arts. Like, do you guys remember the movie Three Ninjas?
No.
Oh, my God.
Was it very racist?
Not at all. I mean, like, I'm sure, actually, it was a 90s movie, so I'm sure there are problematic aspects. Like, but it was about three young boys in the 90s, and they were, like, really into
karate.
Karate. And they, like, fought the bad guys. And I love that shit. And I was like, Mom, I gotta do taekwondo. And so, like, so I did taekwondo for, like, multiple years when I was, like, super young. And I loved it. Like, I was so into it. So, like, martial arts definitely has an appeal for me. I think there's something really beautiful about it. There's also, martial arts and dancing are a lot more similar than you think.
Sure. Are you real? You've never seen MMA?
I haven't.
Are you?
I know.
For real?
I know. I need to watch it.
It's something.
We're going to watch them, like, as soon as we're done with this
episode. We will. Yeah. We'll watch MMA. But however, you know, like, obviously MMA and boxing aren't the same thing, which is what makes this upcoming fight ridiculous.
Yeah.
Boxing, I've never
but it's kind of, oh, I'm sorry.
No. I was just going to say, I think it's important, and we'll get to it, but it's important to kind of distinguish, like, you're talking about mixed martial arts as being, like, dancing and kind of, like, artistic, which we'll get into. And I think where it really gets complicated and kind of thorny is this culture that surrounds what we think of as MMA or, like, UFC.
Yeah.
And that is so, like, antithetical to art and, like,
I mean, I'm not going to
say. So that's why I think it's so hard to see this group of people as artists is, like, the culture that kind of comes with it can just seem so crude at times.
And also, my only...
But it's complicated.
My only example of UFC is Conor McGregor. And
he is a problematic...
He is a real piece of work.
Well, he himself is
a
piece of
shit. I'll smack him on the cauliflower ear. Well, you know, it's funny. So, you know, things like UFC and MMA are interesting in the sense that each fighter brings their really unique set of skills into the ring. So there are fighters that are more based in boxing techniques.
Yeah.
There's fighters that are based in judo and jiu-jitsu.
Dope.
Fighters that are based more in...
Kickboxing,
yes. And so that's, I think, where the crossover comes in.
That makes sense.
Is, you know, you get your people who are more heavily into boxing and, let's say, someone more heavily into judo. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, you got two dudes or two ladies beating the bejesus out of you. And as a spectator, you can't look away. You're just like, oh my God, look at the violence. Like, and that is so interesting to me. And I think that that is sort of where art comes in, is like this idea of the spectacle.
Oh yeah,
for
it
sure.
goes back
there are
so
a lot
far.
Of yeah. I think we'll go over all of them, but there are, however you feel about boxing and MMA and fighting in general, like, there are kind of a lot of parallels between, like, art and fighting.
Yeah.
And just
art is everywhere.
Yeah. Like, that's undeniable. So we're not trying to sway you one way or another, but it's definitely thought-provoking.
Art makes me feel alive. Fighting makes me feel alive. I've looked at a lot of art. I've been in a lot of fights. So I see the correlation.
I think that's a good way to sum it up. All right, so I think we're gonna start way back. We're gonna go way back, and Ginny's gonna talk a little bit about the spectacle of violence back in ancient Roman society.
Yeah, you know, you have to take it way, way back.
Oh, man.
So I was thinking about this episode and, like, spectacle and the performance of violence. And, you know, obviously violence goes back to pretty much the beginning of man and woman, human and all that. But when we think about,
nature.
And nature, oh, yeah, and animals and all of it. But when you think really about, like, spectacle violence, my mind just immediately goes to ancient Rome and gladiators and fights in the Colosseum and in circuses throughout ancient Rome. So I did research mostly on that and came across a lot of really interesting things. So the Colosseum in particular, I read a quote according to psychologist and social philosopher Eric Fromm, said that the Colosseum is one of the greatest monuments to human sadism.
Oh, that's dope.
Yeah, which, you know, makes sense. So, looking at these fights and really, like, the connection that you can make between, like, gladiatorial fights that were performed in ancient Rome, there's a expression from ancient Rome called "give them bread and circus." And what this essentially means is that if there's any kind of social unrest or, you know, they're not making as much, the empire isn't bringing in as much money, so people are hungry, you know, they're displeased with political leaders, what you have to do is give them a little bit of bread and give them some fucking violence in the form of circus fights. So it's either going to be fights or also, too, they would have, you know, chariot races and they would recreate battles. Sometimes these performances were incredibly elaborate where they would fill up amphitheaters with water and construct naval ships in amphitheaters to recreate naval battles. I mean, these people were, like, all about it. So this concept of bread and circus. So when things aren't, you know, going well socially, culturally, let's just give them a whole bunch of spectacle. So that's why, you know, we start looking at these performed fights and how really the reaction of the general public is delight instead of revulsion, which is really interesting. So people file into places like the Colosseum where they could fit thousands of people and watch people kill each other, essentially. You know, you have fighters that are fighting to the death that are also fighting things like lions. I mean, the whole point was to make it as gory as possible. And a lot of this can really be explained by just looking at the Roman civilization itself, which was very violent. It was militant imperialism, violence was a part of ancient Roman culture. There's no getting around that. And so as far as my research has determined, there's been some kind of divergent opinions on gladiatorial fighting itself. So was it sport or was it warfare for spectators? Maybe it was a bit of both. Hard to tell if there was an actual perceived difference in the two, but it's undoubtedly evident that these gladiators had a huge impact on ancient Roman society and that the kind of fighting for spectatorship was a very, very important part of their culture. Gladiators were often immortalized in, you know, they would have tombstones with epitaphs inscribed detailing their accomplishments and their fights and their battles. And the public loved gladiators and they also loved hating certain gladiators. So like with fighting and spectatorship that we have today, they're favorites, they're villains, and people get really into that. So this is the same case in ancient Rome. In terms of art, so ancient Roman society was largely illiterate. So the main way that they had to record and commemorate these fights between gladiators was through visual means, as well as advertising fights. So this was largely done through mosaics, relief sculptures, also personal household items. Like they would have this shit recorded on glassware, ceramics, drink from your wine jug. Oh, there's a couple gladiators fighting at the bottom. So
that's a lot different than the press tour of Conor McGregor.
Right.
Yeah, what we're describing is very like, Oh.
It reminds me of the fucking royal wedding. Right? Porcelain to commemorate.
I would like to see someone with like a fucking coffee cup with like...
No, it needs to be a teacup.
A teacup.
Yeah. Saucer.
I want a teacup with McGregor's face on it. And next to it, it just says, what? W-O-T.
Fook? To fook, yeah. Fook you up. Okay, anyways, I'm not going to make fun of his accent anymore. These gladiatorial fights were commemorated in art, and a lot of this still exists, and they would even have scenes of, you know, these fights oftentimes did actually have referees, which isn't as widely known, and they would show scenes of refs stepping in right before a fatal blow is going to be struck. So, you know, a fighter that was maybe going to be killed lives to fight another glorious day, I guess. So then I came upon this really interesting article called The Art of Ancient Spectacle. This was kind of a question that I had going around in my head, like, you know, is spectatorship, like there is an artistic quality to that, even with the violence and rowdy crowds, you know, because ancient Roman crowds were super rowdy, even rowdier probably than what we have today, because they were drinking. The average Roman, I might get this wrong, but I'm pretty sure, because I read this statistic a while ago and it blew my mind. The average Roman in ancient Rome drank 2 to 2.5 bottles of wine a day.
Damn. Knew how to do it.
That's not that bad.
But to be fair, wasn't it?
You couldn't drink the water.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure
there
was tolerance.
Way more watered down, right?
I'm sure their tolerance was like
crazy. And oftentimes
crazy.
They were. But yeah, I mean, they still turned it up.
Especially not
for events like.
Like one bottle for hydration.
Yeah.
And like,
the other to wind down. Yeah. It was stressful being in ancient Rome. So. Right from the onset, this article that I read by Bettina Bergman, she starts out with a quote, which I think is great, which is, societies and people define themselves through spectacle.
Real.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you can apply spectacle to a lot of different things in our own culture and society, but specifically with this, in talking about spectatorship and as it revolves around these gladiatorial fights. So... really, in a lot of ways, I started thinking about these as like ephemeral performances. So you think about the gladiators themselves, they're either going to be killed in the fights or they're going to become too old and not be able to fight anymore. Animals that they're bringing in, you know, obviously that's not going to last forever. And even when they bring in props, you know, they're building different platforms for fighters to be raised out from the Colosseum, and they're constructing ships for naval battles. And a lot of these things are purposely destroyed for additional spectator enjoyment. And, you know, it's an interesting concept too, in that you think of the way that these, like the Colosseums and the circuses are built, and how we took so much inspiration from them for our own sports complexes, where they're you can think of them act like actual stages. So it's a stage, and then there are, you know, viewers on all sides, and it's like this sort of intimate but not intimate exchange where you have viewers that can view this fight from all angles. It's not like going to a play where it's, you know, you're all facing the stage and the actors are facing you. It's more all encompassing. And in the article, this article that I just mentioned, the author said that there can be little doubt that part of the thrill of attending public events was the potential for anyone and everyone to become a spectaculum, a spectacle themselves, and to enjoy or suffer all that this fleeting status might bring. And I really think that this is something that was kind of intensified with the ancient Romans and we can still see today. I mean, spectators at fights especially, and you see like the press tour of this fight that like people are actively involved in it. Like, you know, they're booing, they're cheering, they're taunting. You know, it's not just like, again, to use kind of like the theater as an example, where the audience is quiet typically and they're just viewing, whereas in fights, the audience almost becomes a part of the fight. Yeah. The spectators are involved in this performance more so than you might see even in other sporting events.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to kind of what we're talking about with the whole press tour thing, too.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why that's so compelling and interesting to watch is because it's not just these two fighters are talking shit, it's the crowd.
Yeah.
It's the sold out crowds that are losing their minds.
Yes.
That paid money
to
watch two people talk shit to each other.
Dude.
Like, it's really...
Which is, if you've watched it, there's nothing, like, honorable or dignified about these conversations. I mean, they're trash talk. Like, it's garbage.
Yeah,
like, what they're saying doesn't make sense. It's not eloquent or interesting. It's really...
Sometimes it's very uncomfortable and kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's crazy.
It seems so scripted oftentimes, too. Like, Jesus.
Who's read The Society of the Spectacle?
I know. I think I've read parts of it.
So
I know I'm familiar with it.
Guy Debord.
Oh yes. Yes.
Is a Marxist theorist, and so I mean, like, straight up.
It's okay. We got some takeout. Hold on, just a second.
Oh, our break. We're gonna take a quick takeout break.
Thai food.
Hey, Nat, did you know that the FDA doesn't require tampon companies to disclose a list of the ingredients in their tampons?
That's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, so major brands use synthetic ingredients in harsh chemical cleansing agents, whereas Lola is 100% cotton and BPA-free.
And for those of you who are a little more environmentally conscious and don't even want to use the applicator, they make applicator lists, they make various sizes, and panty liners for those who want them. And yeah, you can customize your subscription so you can get exactly what you need, you know, in the right sizes.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it gets delivered directly to your door, so you don't have to worry about, like...
Lazy girl's dream.
Exactly. Don't have to worry about running off to the store because they will be there every month at your door. Also, $5 off your first box.
Come on, guys. Can't beat that.
Pretty exciting. Head on over to trymylola.com/babes. That's B-A-B-E-S. And start your subscription today.
Go, guys. Do it.
So, basically, there are some really good quotes in this book. And I'll just say a few things that are relevant, but one of his main thesis to what is in critical theory, the whole idea of spectacle is so huge, people make careers out of this. Mm-hmm. And he claims that social life, authentic social life, has been replaced with its representation.
Ah.
So he argues that the history of social life is understood as the decline of being into having and having into merely appearing. And what I really like about Debord, and something that I think really sums up what's going on with this fight in particular, is his quote, which is that... relations between commodities have supplanted relations between people. So in this case, the fight is the commodity slash also the spectacle. So passive identification with the spectacle is therefore supplanting genuine activity. And that really is where the whole pleasure into watching these events take place kind of plays in. So I'm not even going to try to go on further about this book, because while it is such a thin volume, like it's a very thin book, you could probably read it in a day, you wouldn't understand it.
Yeah.
It's like some heavy, heavy stuff.
Yeah. That's the thing about like the situationists and stuff. It's just like intense, complicated, philosophical material for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean... The whole spectacle thing, like I said kind of earlier, it's so rooted in just being a human. I mean, of course, plenty of humans don't like watching performed violence, but a lot of them do, and it goes way, way back.
Continuing on with this idea of spectacle and how that plays in to our visual culture, there was in the early 20th century this interesting sort of school, this movement in New York City is really where it was based out of, but this brand of gritty realism, American realism, termed the Ashcan School. So the Ashcan School, artists such as Norman Rockwell were familiar.
For sure.
So these people who branded this gritty particular realism, there was a sort of muddy color palette as a way to kind of identify these artists, but well, the biggest thing is that they were in New York City. So these artists really embodied the grittiness. I wish I had a different word to describe it, but the grittiness of New York City in the early 20th century.
It was gritty.
It was gritty, guys.
Gritty as hell.
Muggy. It's still muggy, but at least now they have
AC. It was
AC.
So muggy then.
Oh god, it was so muggy. But one particular artist, a man named George Bellows, painted a very famous work that most of us, I think, are familiar with. It is a highly recognizable piece of art, but it was painted in 1909, and it was titled Both Members of This Club. And it's literally a painting of two people boxing. You can see it nowadays at the National Gallery in D.C. Both Members of This Club. What a highly relevant image, considering not only this upcoming fight that we've been talking about, but also embodying the current atmosphere in America, not only over 100 years ago, but today. So the painting is of two men, one white and one black man, and they're shown in the moment of contact. So they're in the ring fighting. The painting itself is really kind of interesting compositionally. The bodies really form this really dynamic triangle. So you have very quick brush strokes. The figures are well defined, but also not clearly defined. Mm. And so you really get the notion of this like energy, this movement between these two figures. So the people involved are actually real people. So Bellows paints this work in 1909, but shows it in 1910, which was the year of a much-anticipated fight between the heavyweight boxing champion at the time, a man named Jack Johnson, an African-American man, and his challenger, one Jim Jeffries. Jack Johnson and Jim Jeffries.
Those alliteration is a beautiful thing.
Those are some all-American names. So this fight was highly dramatized by this racial animosity. The media was referring to Jim Jeffries as, quote, the last of the great white hopes in boxing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, Jeffries...
Never refer to anything as a great white hope. Just don't do it. Just
unless
never...
it's a shark. If it's a shark, it's fine.
Yeah, if you're hoping for a great white shark, then that could be a great white hope. But in this
maybe
case...
Maybe like a polar bear. I think that would be
oh,
fine.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like a polar bear. Like, I hope I see a great white polar bear. Yeah, but that's it. Yeah, so... there was a lot of racial animosity, and consider the time. This is early 20th century New York City. There's obviously segregation. The Civil War was not that long ago. So very racially charged fight. In the end, Jack Johnson wins. Yay. Screw you, Great White Hope.
I just keep thinking about... banana pancakes and like
what?
I know Jack
chill,
Johnson
chill beach vibes Jack Johnson.
I was listening to so much Jack Johnson and
what? I was like what is Corey
I'm on the same page
about? Corey well I'm out of the loop Anyway, yeah, race is very much thematically and compositionally central in this scene. So you have the not only the image of two boxers engaged in a fight, a black boxer, a white boxer, but also the title, both members of this club. By club, the title's kind of satirical in the sense that Bellows is really making this commentary on these, like, fights. These fights were often prize fights, like, prize fighting was illicit, essentially. Like, you know, you're fighting for money. And these fighting clubs, usually membership was conferred equally to any race. So these were places where, as in, let's say, normally outside of this club, everything is segregated, segregated restaurants, segregated public places, etc. In these kinds of illicit fighting clubs, not only was there interracial interaction, but it was, like, condoned. Yeah. Like, these people were encouraged to fight against each other, sort of as, like, a, you know, who's better kind of mentality. So the title is very indicative of, like, what was going on in these fighting clubs at the time. But also, interesting aspect of this painting is the way that Bellows emphasizes the crowd. In the painting, you have the vantage point of someone who's in the crowd. And so you're watching the fight, and you can see all of the faces of these people in the crowd that are in many ways, like, more excited and animated than the people in the painting. So Bellows famously actually claimed that the atmosphere around the fighters is a lot more immoral than the fighters themselves.
Nice.
So this is interesting because we're seeing this whole, like, shit-talking fest between McGregor and Mayweather, but also the crowds are going insane.
Yeah.
And so in a lot of ways, this speaks to this crowd psychology, which is, like, a big thing in the world of sociology and psychology. So interestingly, the year before Bellows painted both members of the same club was the year 1908, when the first two social psychology textbooks were published that explore this idea of a crowd psychology. So there was one by an Edward Allsworth Ross, who was a sociologist, who wrote that there is a dissolution of the individual identity within the crowd. And so this, therefore, increases the susceptibility of waves of emotion over logical reasoning. I think we've all experienced that at some point.
Oh, definitely.
Where you're in a crowd, you're watching, let's say, like, a basketball game, and you're just going insane, whereas if you're watching it at home, you might be going a little bit insane.
That was when Leo and I went to the playoffs, we went to the viewing party. So it wasn't the actual game even.
Right.
It was at Oracle Arena in Oakland. Everyone paid like $20 to fill the stadium and watch the game on the big teleprompters that was being played in Cleveland.
Right.
And it was crazier than any actual basketball game.
Right.
The crowd was insane. And it was like hella fun because we were all screaming and losing our fucking minds. And it was like the best time ever. But it was very much like it was just a crowd in a room just cheering. Like, it was just, like, there was no actual, like, sporting event even.
Right,
it was literally just a crowd.
And it's a very real thing where crowds feed off of each other's energy.
Yeah.
And this notion was put forth in 1908, which I haven't checked what the current sort of theories are about this, but I think that it's safe to say that it's real, that something about your individual identity melts away when you're in a big crowd.
Definitely.
And
sure.
Therefore, you are way more likely to respond to stimuli in an overly emotional way. protests, which kind of explains things like angry mobs. So that's interesting. Another book by a William McDougall, a psychologist, actually theorized that being in a crowd, being part of a crowd, was a definitive condition of human recreation. So human recreation, in many ways, we seek a crowd. And so it stemmed from what he referred to as the gregarious impulse. So these things, these ideas are floating around in the early 20th century, and Bellows was interested in psychology and into this idea of crowd psychology, and so many of his paintings are famous, not just for, he did a few paintings of boxers, but he also would emphasize the crowd and spent time painting their faces and their reactions. So it's a big jump in time from the Roman Colosseum to Ashcan School painting, but this notion of spectacle violence has really persisted in our visual culture. There's other popular works, countless works by classical artists of, like, wrestlers. We all know the Hellenistic bronze, the boxer. Or, well, we know that. We know
Everybody knows.
If you don't know it, I don't know what to say to you. just kidding. But, yeah, so that is George Bellows. He's a really interesting guy and someone that gets kind of glossed over as far as Ashcan School artists go. So check him out if you're interested in not only American realism, but also these images of, like, inner city sort of gritty early metropolis.
Yeah, we should do an Ashcan School episode.
I think so. I think that would be really good.
That'd be a good one. All right, gonna kind of move forward in history a little bit and kind of, I mean, move away, I guess, from the spectacle of violence necessarily to the modern contemporary artist Ushio Shinohara, who is most famous for his boxing glove paintings. So Shinohara was born in 1932 in Tokyo, Japan, and he moved to New York City in the 60s, where he has pretty much lived and made art ever since. He was a member of the Neo-Dada organizers. His work is kind of like, it's not just his boxing paintings, while those are fairly well known. It moves all over the place. He plays with found object, performance, pop art, and most relevant to this episode, his action paintings. So his work has always done really well in Japan. However, while he was respected in the United States and worked in the United States, he rarely sold anything. But he's been known as a very important voice in contemporary art ever since the 60s. He was deemed the Warhol of Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. which, I don't know, but okay. and he is also the subject of the 2013 Oscar-nominated documentary Cutie and the Boxer.
I want to see that. I haven't seen it yet.
So I really want to see it, too. I was going to watch it today, but I woke up late. So I only watched, I know, right, as just being lazy, and, but I watched a handful of clips, and it looks amazing, like, and I'll talk about it a little bit more, but haven't watched it, but still recommend it. It looks like a really, really good documentary. So as I mentioned, his boxing paintings, obviously very relevant to this episode. He started making them in the 1960s, where he would dip boxing gloves that had foam padding on the top of them in paint or ink. And then he would essentially just, like, go to town on these large standing canvases. Typically with very bright colors and very contrasting colors. So, like, a canvas that would maybe be, like, bright orange. And then he would dip the boxing gloves in maybe like a blue or something, you know, two very different colors. And This was essentially a form of action painting. It was a building off of action painting, like Jackson Pollock and his action painting and his drip paintings, except it was a very specific kind of action you're dealing with, a very, in some ways, violent and intense action, the act of boxing. And he didn't, I mean, he while he was painting with boxing gloves, he was not painting in a way similar to painting with a brush. He was painting as though he was boxing the canvas, which is very essential to the work. Is there the violence of boxing or the just the intensity of the sport comes through in the paintings, and that's kind of the point.
Was he into boxing? Like, did he box
ever? I actually don't know. I read a handful of things about him, and I didn't see anything. I mean, I'm assuming he's in really good shape, and he's in his 80s. I'm assuming he's probably boxed. Like, I don't know that he was ever a competitive boxer or anything. Might just be a sport he's into. But honestly, I'm going to pull up some of the images. Some of these images actually remind me a lot of, like, Cy Twombly's peonies.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Wow,
yeah.
Very cool.
At least that was just kind of a connection I made. This one?
It would be interesting to know if, like, actual boxers could, like, see patterns in his paintings and stuff.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me, we were just talking about the Abby Jacobson podcast, but they had the choreographer on who was talking about how he doesn't like when dance and visual arts are compared, because he was, like, kind of talking about the nuances of the difference, but it was, like, saying that painting is, like, a record of something and that dance is purely ephemeral.
Yeah.
There's no, you can't record, like, the steps the way that a painting records movement.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of reminds me of that. Like, I wonder if people who knew how to box could, like, see moves.
That would be really interesting. That's kind of, part, I mean, so it is action painting, but a huge part of his work is also the performance element.
Yeah, sure.
There are YouTube videos of him making these paintings.
His cute little goggles.
Yeah, and he's also done
that. He's pretty adorable.
In front of, well, hold on. But, mean, he is, but it's complicated. So he's also done them in front of crowds. There's very a performance element to these works. And I watched a few of these videos today, and he does use different techniques. He uppercuts the canvas. He, mm-hmm. It's not just him just like punching. So obviously he understands something about boxing technique, There's actually one video on YouTube that I'll post on our sources that's by Zachary Henserling, who is also the director of Cutie and the Boxer. And it's really, I think, a very beautiful artistic portrayal of this performance of Shinohara doing these boxing paintings. It's Shinohara, and he's creating a boxing painting, but on glass. And the entire video, it's only a couple minutes long, but it's done in slow motion. And there's kind of this, like, big ambient music behind it, which is a little melodramatic at times, but it's still, like, very beautiful. And there's all these close-up shots of, like, paint flying in the air and, like, slow-mo, like, drips of paint and stuff. It's a very, I think it
reminds
takes
me of a Guy Ritchie movie. Yeah. What I'm envisioning is, like, a Guy Ritchie movie.
I think it takes Shinohara's work and the performance of his work and then filters it through another artistic lens in a very interesting way. So definitely check that out. Interestingly, like, despite the fact that he has been very well known since the 60s, he is not, like, he has had work exhibited at the Tate Modern, at the Pompidou, at the MoCA in LA. Like, he's had work in a lot of very prestigious museums. He is not very well off financially. Like, he's never made a lot of money off of his work.
Hmm.
Him and his wife, Noriko, and their son, Alex, all live in kind of this, like, fairly dilapidated loft in New York City. And they're all artists. So they all live there and they all make work there. I mean, it's a good space. Like, it's obviously he does large-scale paintings. So, and to have a big space in New York City, you obviously need to make something. Like, you can't be, but it's not like he's living super wealthy. So, kind of going back to the documentary that I was talking about, though, Cutie and the Boxer, I was only able to watch clips of it, but it's essentially about the relationship right. between Ushio Shinohara and his wife, Noriko, and they're both artists, and Noriko's work has also gained recognition recently, and it's basically a series of illustrations called Cutie and the Bully, which is about their life together and their kind of really dysfunctional relationship. Yeah, and I like I said, I only watched some clips. I didn't get to watch the whole documentary, but I'm going to watch it maybe even tonight, actually, because I'm very intrigued. But they've been together for 40-some years, and it is not, I think, I don't think anyone would describe what they have as a healthy relationship.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there isn't love there, but yeah. it gets uncomfortable at times, and that's kind of what Noriko's work deals with, is this balance of love and also all the bullshit that she's put up with, kind of a thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and they have a very, like, tumultuous back and forth, but it isn't without... You can tell that they care about each other. It isn't without, like,
it's
laughter
like
and stuff.
It's not like a victim and... Like pure victim situation.
Yeah, yeah, but it still is complicated and uncomfortable at times. And there's one quote by Noriko in the documentary where she's talking about their relationship, and she says, "We are like two flowers in one pot. Sometimes we don't get enough nutrients for both of us, but when everything goes well, we become two beautiful flowers." Oh. I was like, that is nice.
Yeah.
That is a nice thing. But like I said, I haven't watched the documentary yet. I'm looking forward to it, but there's definitely a tension about this marriage, and there's like an intensity about it, which I think parallels his boxing work in a very real way, because these paintings represent an intensity and a tension and kind of a violence, and I think all of those things are interrelated in mm-hmm. some ways. So some things to think about. But yeah, I mean, he's still making work. He's like 85 now, wow. I think. I know, and he's in great shape for 85. Yeah. Out there making boxing paintings. But I know, like, these paintings also get a lot of criticism from people, especially people not really into art. They're like, how is this art, you know? I mean, I guess the same way, like, Jackson Pollock got criticism.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, what do you guys think of these, of, like, his boxing images?
I think I like the ones with more color, just personally. But I think they're interesting.
And they're kind of beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
like that one.
They're a record of movement, which is, yeah, I don't know. I keep going back to that, like, choreography comparison. But, like, they're more about the movements that he made than necessarily what's left behind. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe would help people to appreciate them
for
a
sure.
little bit more.
Yeah.
It's not just focusing on what stays, but thinking a little beyond.
I think they're interesting and dynamic, and I can appreciate them in the sense that they're really different. I haven't seen anything like this before. I mean, yes, Cy Twombly's.
But that's
that's totally.
Yeah, like, they're completely different.
They just sort of compositionally have that. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole of, is this art? I mean,
I definitely think it is art.
I think
art.
It's
like,
art.
I'm,
like, yeah,
like 100%. But it's just, I can also understand why some people maybe are a little critical, I guess. But visually, I don't know. If you appreciate action painting, you'll appreciate these,
yeah.
I think.
I wonder if they're cathartic for him.
I feel like they have to be.
Yeah.
I would love to do that.
I would love to
punch a canvas. That sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah. They're great.
Yeah. They're very interesting. We'll obviously have some images up on the website for you guys to look at. But Ushio Shinohara, check him out. And then Nat.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good segue into my topic, which is a little more theoretical. So I am going to be talking about our dear, dear friend Meryl Streep. And the
our
comet.
close personal friend, Meryl
yes,
Streep.
She couldn't make it today, but just a scheduling error. No, but I mean, many of you probably know that Meryl Streep made a very rousing speech this year at the last year, I guess, at the Golden Globes. I myself am not a huge awards person.
Yeah, me
either. I don't really watch any of the award shows. I like a lot of the shows and movies that get awarded, but I have no interest in watching people parade. it's just not my deal. But she made a speech that I did hear about post Golden Globes, where in truly like 3 seconds she brings up fighting, but it caused a whole uproar, backlash. So the speech in general was very pro-diversity. She had a lot to say in criticism of our current president, Donald Trump. And for the most part, I agree with a lot of what she talked about. There is this moment that we are going to discuss today where she says, Hollywood is crawling with outsiders and foreigners, and if we kick them all out, you'll have nothing to watch but football and mixed martial arts, which are not the arts. So, this very small piece of the whole speech garnered a lot of backlash from the MMA community, people who support MMA. Really what I think it comes down to is she picked the wrong sport to choose.
Yeah.
But it brings up a lot of interesting questions. And I have some articles that I've found that respond to this, and not in a super aggressive way, but in a pretty rational way, just defending MMA as a sport and mostly as an international sport, which I think there is a lot of merit there, because first and foremost, which we talk about all the time, is that art is subjective, and
yeah.
We have to come to that. Like, what is art is looming over every episode that we do, everything we talk about. It's just omnipresent.
Yes.
So, you know, why is it not in this? You know, what is art? Is MMA art? MMA, I'm sure you guys figured out now, is mixed martial arts. in this, you know, art is subjective, but also art kind of parallels fighting in the way that there are those who fight out of true necessity, and there are those who fight out of sport and out of, like, desire to fight and interest in it. And you can kind of say the same thing about art. There are people who create art out of necessity, and there are people who just feel like they are put on earth to create art for art's sake. Like, there's just kind of an overlap there that I hadn't realized until I was reading about this. And personally, I'm always one to like the underdog. So
definitely.
In art, and it kind of overlaps into fighting, because I'm not a huge UFC boxing fan by any stretch, but I'm not above being entertained by it when I really pay attention, when I'm interested. I know people who like watching it. I have watched fights, and there's definitely an element of entertainment that been pulled into. And I will 100% root for the person who's fighting, in my mind, more so out of necessity than the other. You know, like, it's never, like, really a whole underdog story. It just doesn't ever work out that way unless you're watching a movie. But if there is somewhat of an underdog, that's generally who I just lean toward. And it's the same way in art. I mean, you love to hear about people who really pull themselves out, like, up by their bootstraps and make a name for themselves in any situation. And I like to see that parallel, first of all. And it's important to say, like, boxing as an American tradition has been around for a while. MMA is pretty recent. I mean, I found out through this research that as of 2005, UFC fighters were not rich. They were not bringing in a lot of money. So in 2008, when Conor McGregor quit his plumbing career, and decided to go train to become an MMA fighter.
I can't imagine what it'd be like if that guy walked into my house to, like, fix my fucking sink. I'd be like, who is this person?
He would yell at you for not having used
There's
a drain
fucking
stopper.
Fucking hair in the bed.
But it is important to note, because he is such a ridiculous shit talker, that when he did enlist in this gym and start training, there was no, like, shining beacon of, like, rags to riches that he was chasing. This was not something that had happened, so I don't know, like, there's something kind of earnest in that, but, like, he was doing it for wanting to be an MMA fighter, not for wanting some sort of fame or wealth at that point. He's come a long way since then, so I'm not, like, defending, but that's an important note. And just to note that fighting is truly, if we're going to talk about, like, race, fighting is extremely inclusive. As far as global business, like, if you go through UFC fighters, there are people from all, like, the whole gamut. There's no, I mean, we were talking about white supremacy earlier. Like, yeah. There's not a white supremacy in fighting, which, you know, refreshing. That's a positive. We'll hold on to that. And, yeah, so I have this quote from a Nobel Prize winner, Andre Gide, that says, "Art begins with resistance at the point where resistance is overcome. No masterpiece has ever been created without great labor." So you can find these kind of theoretical art statements that you can apply to fighting. Like, there are, it's there. I want to hear from you guys what you think, and then I have some more material, but we can kind of tease through this
a little. Whether we think it's art or not?
Yeah.
Okay, well, my feelings towards Meryl Streep is I do fucking love her, and I did fucking love everything she had to say at those awards, because she said a lot of important shit. So I don't want to get caught up on, like, one little line that she said, because no. I think, like, everything exactly. She said was so important. Yeah. But it's probably not surprising, but I'm definitely in the camp of, like, everything is art, like, life is art. Like, I think anything that is approached in a way that is meant to express yourself and the way you relate to the world can be art, and if that is some form of martial arts, like, definitely. Like, it definitely takes effort and time, and it also takes creativity. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So, like, I'm 100% on the side of, I mean, not just mixed martial arts, sports. I think sports can definitely be art.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Totally. And I think what basically happened in this situation is that you could defend most sports in this context, but martial arts seems to have, or, like, mixed martial arts, I'll be technical, seems to have, like, a lot of just hard evidence as to why it can't be discounted, that maybe other sports could be, like, teased through a little more.
And I also felt like her choice was just kind of for the sake of play on words.
Exactly. She really just got kind of, like, caught in
this.
And I don't even know that she would really, if she got into a debate with someone, and I'm not speaking for Meryl Streep, but who knows if she would really defend herself, or if she would kind of, you know.
Because theoretically speaking, Meryl Streep is an actress, acting is performance, and mixed martial arts are also a form of performance, at least when we relate it back to the idea of spectacle.
Yeah.
So if performance is art, then they're just as much artists as she is.
Yeah, exactly.
I would like to ask an MMA. Whoa! I would like to ask an MMA fighter or UFC or boxer or whatever if they think that what they're doing is performance.
Yeah,
I would like to
know, right?
What they think, because I feel like it could go real south fast. Like, I don't know what they think.
I feel like it could go both ways.
Yeah,
I bet you anything.
Sure, it depends on the fighter.
I'm sure there are some that probably, like, fucking feed off the spectacle, and that's why they do it, and they love it. And then I'm sure there's some that don't like that aspect of it at all.
But, and there was a nice Francis Ford Coppola quote where he talks about risk being a necessary part of any, like, true art. And so the idea that there are genuine stakes in fighting is what kind of pushes it to that almost, like, higher art form. Is it's not something that you can really replicate in a lot of performance, is that there are genuine stakes and people can genuinely get hurt. And that, I think, is, for me at least, that's what causes me the most discomfort. Is I love boxing and fighting movies because I know that no one's actually getting hurt. The actual fights, I can appreciate the artistry, but I also, like, I mean, I feel my heart sink when someone really gets hurt. It's yeah. so hard to watch and not just, like,
yeah.
feel, like, genuinely upset if someone's, like, risking their life genuinely.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and there's all of the, like, factors that go into fighting, and that's what's getting so interesting with this Mayweather-McGregor fight, is it's boxing and MMA coming together.
Right.
So, you know, all of the...
To be fair, it's technically boxing, and McGregor's just saying, I can do that, which yeah. is, like, because it's not...
He's calling it a right. half fight, or yeah. half of a fight.
Because it's yeah. a boxing match. It's boxing.
Yeah.
He has to box. It's not MMA, but he's an MMA fighter.
But yeah, but to be technical, what it's coming down to is there's always so many factors in a fight between physical attributes, between skills, between training, all of the, I mean, size, all, and, you know, size is, like, kind of in there because they, you know, have weight classes and whatnot. But even that, if you know anything about wrestling and fighting, that is even, like, kind of arbitrary when it comes down to it with cutting and all of that, whatever. My brothers wrestle. I know too much. But, yeah, so all of these factors are being, like, multiplied, which they're already, it's so, I mean, if you follow it at all, like, predictions and stuff, yeah, it's like, crazy. People don't know. There's too many things going on, and I think that's part of what draws people in, is there's so many question marks and just unknowns. And then I think the last thing that I want to end on that I read about this is, like, that I saw, like, a genuine parallel is someone mentions that to be successful in fighting, you need grit, determination, and luck. And honestly, I couldn't think of a better way to describe successful artists. Like,
yes.
Like, talent, pure talent does not get you anywhere in anything. Like, it does take a certain level of, like, just determination yeah, and sure. truly luck. Like, yeah. and successful artists will tell you that you don't get it just for being good or just for working hard. Like, you kind of need that luck.
It's the beautiful mixture of all of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Definitely. And
yeah, I think.
Well, before we do listener mail, should we all, who do we think is going to win? Who's everybody betting on?
Mayweather.
I mean, I don't want McGregor to win, but I have a feeling he's going to win.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't really want either of them to win. I know, right? What if they both just knock each other out?
My thing that's, like, I don't really like either of them as people.
Neither.
So it's not really that. My whole thing is, like, McGregor is not a boxer. And the last time he's boxed anyone, he didn't do very well.
Yeah.
So, like, he's great at mixed martial arts, but he has in no way proven to be good at boxing, so I have no reason to believe he's going to do well.
Right.
So that's my personal take on it, but I could totally be wrong.
I mean, as far as, like, who I want to win, I think I would want Mayweather to win, just because I literally any time that McGregor opens his mouth, I just want to, like, fight him.
Yeah.
And so I would like that to be the outcome. But yeah, like we said, they're both terrible human beings.
They are. They're both. I think that's it. Neither one of them are great humans, but Mayweather is the best boxer of all time,
yeah,
and McGregor
yeah.
is not. So, like,
wait a minute. Of all time?
Yeah, he's considered one of the greatest boxers of all time.
One of them, but not the best.
Some people would argue that he is the best
yeah.
of all time.
I don't believe it.
You think I'm lying to you?
Tyson forever.
Oh, fuck, Tyson. Jesus. Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know that much about
I don't know boxing, shit about boxing.
But
so.
I do know that people, there are plenty of people I consider him the best boxer
yeah.
of all time. Obviously, that's subjective as well, but, like.
Right.
I really wish that McGregor hadn't, like, shown his little fucking racist, or not even shown his racist side. I wish he didn't have this racist
yeah.
side.
I wish he wasn't racist.
I wish it didn't exist, because I just remember, I mean, I'm way out of date on my UFC boxing, any sort of fighting knowledge, but I just remember being in high school and seeing McGregor, and that's when he was, like, new on the block, and me just kind of thinking that he was, like, charismatic and interesting, and I loved his accent, and, you know, he's He's kind of hot in that, like...
No!
And I mean, I get it. I mean, like, I'm not physically...
Listen, when I heard him speaking earlier, I was disgusted. I'm not acting like anything that he says attracts me in any way. Truly, everything that comes out of his mouth about this fight disgusts me. But what I had in my memory from being younger, I remember thinking that he was, like... someone that I would want to root for, and now I'm bummed out because I don't feel that way at all.
No, yeah. I feel you. And it's not about his face, it's about his confidence. Yeah. He's got, like, crazy confidence that sometimes he has mad swagger that can be, I think, read as attractive. Yeah. But then you're like, oh, you're a piece of shit.
Yeah. But the stuff that I heard him say, and literally anything that he said in all of those press releases are just, ugh.
The whole thing's gross.
It's really bad.
And we're all going to watch as a society as it plays out.
And we're
going to
get real emotional over it. And we're just going to be like, ah!
And it's going to be everywhere. And it's just, I don't know. The things we choose as a culture to be like excited about, man, is crazy. At the end of the day, both of them...
We haven't changed that much from the Romans.
I know, right?
Right?
Say it now.
At the end of the day, they're both making hella money off this shit.
Yeah, for real.
It's crazy.
Yeah, they don't care who wins.
I know, right?
I don't think they do either.
I guarantee they don't. It doesn't make a difference.
Okay, who wants to read this listener mail?
I can do it. All right, Jen. Subject line, your period amazing, period. Art history, babes. Wow. I just love you ladies. I found your podcast this summer and I've been absolutely binging on it ever since. It seriously got me through a 12-hour ride to and from Virginia Beach with my 3 kids, 8, 6, and 4.
Oh, man.
Oh, you go, girl. I'm a high school art teacher in upstate New York. My undergrad degree is a BFA with art history minor and I received my master's in teaching visual arts. I cannot wait to share the knowledge I've received from your podcast with my students. Aww. I love how you look at art history with a feminist lens. For future podcasts, would you ever consider covering Louise Bourgeois?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I love her with her big bronze dicks.
Or perhaps Kiki Smith.
Yes, yeah, definitely. We will.
I love those art babes so, so much. I had given a presentation about Kiki in an art since 1945 class, and my argument was about whether I thought she was a feminist artist or not. I actually argued that no, she was not. Please continue being so fucking badass. I hope my daughter can be as awesome and as intelligent and as... Wow. This is just ironic. Can be as awesome and intelligent as all of you someday. Rock on, Jen.
Aww.
That is so kind.
That really is. I don't know. For me, like, that's one of the nicest ones we got. Like, if you want your kid to be like us, like, that's
high praise.
Your kids weren't too traumatized by listening to us for 12 hours.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah. Especially they were watching something on, like, an iPad.
Yeah. We curse a lot, so, you know.
That's it's okay. Cool, like,
thanks, Jen.
My parents cursed all the time when I was growing up. I was fine. Like, it's not that big of a deal.
Right. That's why I swear so much now.
Just words. It's just words. It's fine. That's what we got for you today. Make sure to be checking out our Patreon. We, starting in September, are going to have bonus episodes on our Patreon. Patreon.com/arthistorybabes. So if you donate literally anything and become a patron, you will have access to monthly bonus babes.
Dang.
So make sure to check that out. Email us at arthistorybabes.com. Write us reviews on iTunes. Hit us up on Twitter. We're trying to get that Twitter game going. Facebook, Instagram. You know what it's about.
You know what it's about.
Am I missing? I feel like I'm missing something.
Watch the fight.
Watch the fight.
And let us know what you think.
We're also, head over to our website, arthistorybabes.com. Head over to our website, arthistorybabes.com. Two big things happen in there. We have a subscriber list on the contact tab. So if you type in your email address, you will get newsletters from us about all kinds of cool stuff. So subscribe to our newsletter and also be on the lookout, dropping September 1st, Art History Babes merch.
Yes.
We're doing it.
We're finally doing it.
It's happening.
You can wear us.
You'll be like, what are you wearing? It's Art History Babes.
Exactly. So be on the lookout for all those super cool things, because art history babes are just out here just living, just doing it.
We're just trying to function.
We really are. I think that kind of sums up what we're trying to do right now as being post-grads with no job. We're just trying to function.
Yeah, pretty much. Literally.
But thank you for listening. This is a fun episode with, I think, a lot of controversial topics, so email us. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, for real.
And we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Love you, bye.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
You got that Thai food?
Yeah. Here's veg rolls.
Veg rolls! veggie portabella rolls.
Hot stickers.
Yes. Tonka.
And I have snackies.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.